You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic. I'm Cameron Lalana.
And I'm Matt Garasimovich.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 50 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, turning from the death camps to another member of the party who was arrested with, along with Aunt Sofia Leventon and Mostovskoy, the guard with them, the driver Semyonov, who you may remember. I think there's one reference to him at the beginning of this book.
I thought he was the main character. I was waiting for him to come back up. Actually.
Right.
I was like, where'd he go?
We've been saying Vavilov and Semyonov. Where are those two?
Where'd
the
go?
Main characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you'll have a slightly more familiarity with him if you read Stalingrad, although he only appears for a couple chapters at the end of the book. So this is like the most screen time Semyonov has ever gotten in this entire series so far. So and for him, it's all bad times, although he does not sent to a death camp. Even the process of transportation to a camp almost results in him starving to death. And in fact, he's in such a bad state that the Germans decide it's not worth taking him. He's not going to live. It's not worth shooting him either because it's a waste of a bullet. So just leave him on the ground and let's go. Which leads to him managing to pull himself into a woman's house who, against his, to his surprise, actually takes care of him and brings him back to health, and then hides him, which continues to the end of the chapter when, there is sort of a, when he's talking to her and their neighbor and they tell him about what we would term the Holodomor, right? The famine that resulted from collectivization policies in Ukraine in the 1930s, which was exacerbated by an unwillingness to address the famine and instead blame the shortcomings on the theoretical, possibly real, probably theoretical kulaks, a very vague phrase even in that time, which led to the deaths of millions of people, which he does not entirely understand, and being the first time that he's ever even come across this idea. And is there anywhere in this that you'd like to begin?
Yeah, that idea of almost like the imagined kulak is kind of interesting. I think, like you said, theoretically, they existed as these sort of small scale landowners that did whatever you would do as a landowner, put away some food, some rations, some storage, put some of your harvest into storage. And this was all taken away. And these people are left with essentially nothing as Christia is recounting everything. I mean, every last grain is taken away basically. And so this chapter is kind of not as much, I would say, one for analysis per se, as it's almost a little bit of like a historical exploration a little bit, because this would have been taboo to criticize for sure.
Right. If you people were even aware of it, which many were not at this
right,
time.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was going to say, is largely probably the people that come from Semyonov's circle, which are Muscovites, they're not really aware of what life is like on the peripheries. And in some cases, because of the fact that, and I'm not talking about Ukraine, I just mean peripheries specifically of the Soviet Empire, they may have been, that some people have posited that there were instances where there was more freedom because there was a little bit less oversight, maybe some access to foreign goods, maybe this was a little bit easier to come by, things like that. But that being said, a lot of the produce, specifically a lot of the goods that would have been used for the people of those regions, were sort of forcibly exported to the center, and this is what essentially causes so many people to starve and to go without these very basic necessities. And I was talking to one of my friends from this region, and talking about when me and you, Cameron, were in Russia, how somebody one of our professors that we were talking about, how they were talking about how in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they went basically a decade without eating a fruit or a vegetable. And she said, yeah, that's because they were taking it all from our regions. And I think that that's a good encapsulation sort of what this chapter is is getting at a little bit, but just this it just, I don't know. It continues to be interesting to me that this is where Grossman places this particular chapter. This almost one-off that we would have forgot about had he not reminded us 600 pages in.
It also is interesting that it then moves on to, I think, Victor after this. So there's this one small moment. It's not the start of a new arc. It almost seems to naturally draw your attention, like thematically, between what came before, what is, right? And then what is here. I think it's worth talking about, when you talk about kulaks, again, like we say,
When
that's a
you
very
everyday people talk about kulaks so
has,
frequently, when you're at work and
because
your boss asks you about kulaks, only my boss does that, probably not yours, you know.
No, they asked me to write a report condemning the kulaks and say we need to do some investigation into how they've been hoarding grain. And I say I really don't know if there's evidence for that, and say no, we need it by 5 o'clock. And I say okay, right. But like this idea, when I say it's vague, I don't just mean that now people don't understand what a kulak is. I mean even then people didn't really entirely understand what a kulak was always. I think. This is like a half-remembered paper, but I remember we covered, forget which podcast it was, and I won't find it because we've got so many. But I read to write a paper for one of them, which basically outlined a story and outlined that there was a after the and this is in kind of the core, and this is in, I think, the Russian ASSR specifically, that a lot of the hardline policies had to be pulled back to a degree. They had to be reined in because it became apparent even to Moscow at that time that the vagueness of what a kulak was basically allowing regional administrators to get away with doing whatever and blaming it and saying, well, that was the we had to counter the kulaks. Like it was so egregious that even in that time they realized that. And that's kind of in, as you say, in the core of empire. So when we're looking at peripheries, in periphery, it being all the periphery nations, in places like Ukraine, it's, as you say, not surprising that the citizens of core would not understand what is happening to the peripheries and is as we do, like as Semyonov in this chapter just is literally like can't even fathom, right, these people or their struggles. And following up on that too, you might add, if you wonder how Grossman knows this, he knows this because he was in Ukraine during parts of the Holodomor. So right, so like he knows this and he's bringing it up because he was there for parts of it, but most other people would not be. And this is one of the things that really shocked me, that it is again one of those things that like I can't believe he put this in this book expecting him to get published.
Yeah, it probably doesn't seem that radical for like a modern viewer, but it, yeah, no, it, or a modern reader, but it is.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is going back to that point a little earlier where I think it's interesting that you start to we go from the death camps to here. I think it's notable that although it's spoken of in very vague terms, it's this the woman who takes him in, it's apparent that most of her family was wiped out, not by the invading fascists, but by various out features of the Soviet Empire, one way or another. Disappearances, deaths by hunger. Even some opportunity, which then, lets her daughter move on and has with little interest in talking to her mother, right? All these things that the Soviet Union has brought, for better or for worse. And I think it's just in, as you say, not too much for analysis, but an interesting reflection on for at that time would have been fairly recent history.
Yeah, and this is my thing with the peripheries. I think there are maybe some instances where you can say that there were parts that were I don't want to say better, right, than the center, but maybe less restrictive in some ways. And at certain times of history, that's probably true. I don't think at this time that that's true by any means, because at this time and especially early on in the Soviet Union, if you're on the periphery that is changing hands between Soviets and not Soviets, people are getting murdered by both sides for even the slightest intimation that you are collaborating with either side. And that is discussed to some degree here. It's discussed in other early Soviet literature, and it's a historical fact, right? So it's very difficult, and this chapter kind of highlights, I think all the conversations go to highlight that what really matters is how people behave to each other, despite the fact that you might be a Soviet trying to, get rid of your enemies in a certain area, or whatever it is that's happening in that region. What sticks out to these people are the individuals who are just decent human beings, who are not sadistic and cruel, and who are just, you can experience this as a human, and not as, like we've sort of said here, like an imagined kulak, or just this imagined enemy, that they're able to perceive each other just as humans. And I think that that is one of the things that sticks out to me about this chapter, because there are Germans who are good, Germans who are bad. It's clear that there are Soviets who are good and who are bad. And I don't mean abstractly, I mean directly in relation to the characters that we're talking about today. It kind of cuts both ways.
Right. Yeah. It feels like a spiritual Ikonnikov is resurrected in the scene where I think it's Ikonnikov who gives the example of human kindness being, a Soviet woman giving aid to a fascist soldier whose comrades are killing her husband. Well, we have here, a corollary. We have an old woman who's treating a Soviet soldier whose comrades, loosely speaking, killed most of her family.
Are you looking at
So.
Discord right now?
I'm not. Is that
Oh,
an example given?
I literally just three, like, I mean, 5 seconds before you started saying that, Discord user rang and just posted about that exact thing. Wow, that's creepy.
The hive mind carries on.
That's right. That's
Okay, well,
right.
hold on. Do you want to read those? Let's see.
No, you got it. That's why I was like, are you reading this? That's weird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, it was Ikonnikov's essay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Big ups to Reagan for that.
I believe technically Reagan had the thought before you, so
Yeah.
had to retract that.
Reagan scooped me on that one. So, all
Yeah, he
credit
did. Yeah, you got scooped.
to. I also like the introduction of the picture of someone who appears to have been crying with the line, "Me almost recovering from Sophia and David's chapters and diving back in." Yeah, I think that's how a lot of us felt going in today.
I thought that this chapter, though, the topic of hunger, it was a good encapsulation, I think, of what Grossman is talking about when in the previous chapter, when he's talking about death and that gradual progressive denial of freedom and uniqueness and humanity and what hunger can reduce a person to. And I mean, the scenes in this chapter are very, very graphic, and really, I don't know that most people can imagine what that type of hunger is really like. That is to be starved for. We don't really know exactly how long he's been starved for, because it's said that he spends 10 weeks in a camp around the front, where he's probably very poorly fed. I cannot imagine, either side are feeding their prisoners when there is very little to eat at the front to begin with. And then the 10 days on the transport to the next camp where they're not fed, to crawling to the village where he's obviously not fed, to the point that he can't even eat, and eating anything makes him just violently vomit. And it's a complete denial of a person's humanity. And we see this on an individual level when we say, wow, this is really terrible. But this chapter really gives us this kind of portal into is a time in which this was a common borderline official practice, right, of starvation. And that's it just continues to unfold, this novel, the different levels of complexity.
Right. It did echo very strongly. Maybe did this for you. It calls to mind very strongly Varlam Shalamov's Kalima Tales, this one short story we covered many, many years ago. Now, that's surreal to say that we've did this many years ago on this podcast, of a prisoner who's been sent out to get some wood or something, I believe, who's experiencing just a level of like hunger that it goes beyond what I presume you and I presume a lot of our audience it could possibly understand as hunger, like that level of just complete physical deterioration as a result of it. So I don't know if Grossman would ever have read Shalamov. I do believe they're aware of each other, but it's a tough that was Shalamov is tough to read. This chapter is tough to read. Not a pretty era.
No, it's not a good time for anyone here, I don't think. But it was a good chapter. It was a longer one for Grossman. Yeah. So clearly, even though it's a borderline standalone, he, wants you to notice it and they make a point of it.
Yeah. Well, it does, just the portrait, again, he really shines in his portraits of just life, of this kind of living, of this community, which is kind of emptied out by murder, of the fascists, emptied out by the famines. And yet you have all these characters, this kind, this woman who maintains that sort of Tolstoyan kindness, the old czarist artilleryman. It's really shines in writing communities like this and in this and throughout all of his other works.
Yeah, if he just wrote short stories like this, I think that he would be also a great short story writer. That like he would be remembered as a great short story writer if he wrote just, a bunch of these.
Right.
And he would also be subjected to retroactive torture of being covered on our podcast.
No one and nothing is safe from us. All right. Well, absolutely. Maybe in that case, this is a good place to wrap up for today.
Yes, I think so. And in that case, you will be hearing from us again soon.